You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for February 19th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the grand reopening of the Bush Administration Hall of Failures. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, Driftglass.
Hey, Blue Gal. Such a boring week. You got nothing to talk about.
No, it wasn't.
Let's talk about the weather.
Let's talk about, well, we're going to hold off on talking about Scalia for a minute because I really want to do this as chronologically as possible. And actually, Scalia died before the debate Saturday night, so that is chronological. However, I want to start with the debate and then go on to the aftermath.
Yeah.
Scalia passing. Mm-hmm. May he rest in peace. And this debate was one for the record books.
Awesome. It was awesome. It will be studied
and
for years.
You laughed, you cried, you kissed 2 hours goodbye.
I did.
And we want to thank the listener who sent you a Republican debate survival kit.
You did.
In the form of a very nice bottle of scotch and a contribution. Thank you very much for that.
Indeed. And a wonderful letter, and just thank you all around.
I
fortified myself. I'll really say that. I fortified myself.
You will say that he took a sip or two of scotch during this debate. He did.
I did. I tweeted it. I could not. There's a way in which I just switched my brain off. I switched my editing brain off and just type and transcribe quickly. And I really couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was
amazing. What is Trump up to? Because this was really a truth-telling moment. A lot of liberals were kind of angry and bitter at themselves for agreeing with Donald Trump. But
no reason to be angry or bitter. I reassure all of my liberal friends, all of my brothers and sisters out there, no reason to be. Because here's what I think happened. May I explain to you my theory?
You may.
First of all, Eugene Robinson, it was syndicated in our paper today, has a pretty good take on this. And believe it or not, David Frum, of all people, writes about it in The Atlantic, I think. But what cracks me up is hearing mainstream media people, relatively timid liberals like Eugene, or Bush speechwriters like David Frum, arriving at the same place we've been at for a really long time.
Yeah.
In the case of Trump, you know, all the way back to June of last year, when we were saying, take him seriously, or going back to, you know, when we started blogging or started podcasting about the nature of the Republican Party. This is what was awesome about that. He fragged them inside the perimeter.
He
said the unsayable thing. He said the thing you're never, ever supposed to say.
He said the thing that the both siderists don't say. Not just what that the Republicans don't say, but that the both siderists won't say.
He violated the agreed upon narrative.
Yeah.
And you know who?
Of everybody.
Well, not everybody. Yeah. Liberals have been saying this for
Well, everybody in the Beltway, I mean.
Yeah. We shall not, don't talk about, this is the perfect example of a totally dysfunctional, abusive family.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump, for one brief shining moment, was the kid inside the house at Thanksgiving dinner saying, no, Dad's a drunk and he beats up people.
Yeah.
The one thing you're never supposed to say, he said out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And it set off a chain reaction that is still happening, you know, is still making people laugh or cry or freak out or run away or whatever. But little noticed by the media was that John Kasich, said something similarly unsayable, similarly
mm-hmm,
taboo,
mm-hmm.
when he said a couple of days prior or before that in
print, at one of his town halls,
at
right?
One of town hall meetings.
Yeah.
That we, the Republican Party, we blew the surplus.
Yeah.
We blew the surplus. We did that. Which is, you're never supposed to say, you're never supposed to mention there was a surplus. I mean, for a long time, my conservative friends would look me straight in the eye and say, or straight in the email and say, there wasn't a surplus. That's just a myth. It never happened. But George Bush ran explicitly on getting rid of that horrible, horrible budget surplus.
Yes, he did.
And
it was in his speech to the Republican National Convention.
Yes, it was in his campaign ads. He mocked people who said otherwise. David Brooks was one of those, you know, filthy little Weekly Standard hacks who were mocking liberals for suggesting that a $1 trillion tax cut would somehow cause a deficit. That's just crazy talk. And the Beltway has all agreed never to mention that again because it's their friend. It's their establishment buddies. It's the people in the donor class.
It's the cocktail party. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the rich people. It's the people in the donor class. So what the donor class has done for the last, since the end of the Bush administration, because the cardinal sin, I've maintained this always, and I maintain this to this very day, the cardinal sin that George Bush committed in the eyes of conservatives is not that he invaded the wrong country or lied us into a war or tortured people or tapped phones or blew up the deficit, which was supposed to be the worst thing you could ever do, all while Republicans applauded. No, the worst thing he did was humiliate the Republicans' base voter in front of their liberal friend.
Mm-hmm.
He made them look like the stupid people they are. He made them look like the caricatures of idiot, know-nothing, no-neck, inbred morons that they actually are in front of the hated liberals. So all those people that were sneering and mocking and calling us un-American and calling us traitors and calling us French and whatever else had to eat shit when George Bush, when his war fell apart. And they couldn't fucking stand it.
Yep.
So what did they do? Well, a grown-up would examine themselves and figure out what they've done wrong and maybe how they screwed up, etc. But these are children. These are angry, paranoid, racist children. So they did what angry, paranoid children do. They denied it ever happened.
Well, and they went so far as to rename their political structure.
Right.
They are now Tea Party and not Republican, right?
Except, as we know, there is no Tea Party.
That's exactly right.
There is no,
these are the same people who voted for Bush twice.
And so the Koch brothers and the donor class invented for the base a magic machine in which they could step and emerge out the other side, magically cleaned and completely exonerated from any knowledge of what happened before 2009. They never voted for Bush. They never supported Bush. That wasn't me. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a Tea Party member. I'm a constitutional conservative. I suddenly give a shit about deficits, even though 10 minutes ago I couldn't care less.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And again, the entire Beltway went along with it. The entire corrupt Beltway establishment let them get away with it. And that's what creamed Barack Obama. That's his biggest mistake, was not calling them out on that right away, not stepping on their neck the minute they tried that. He tried to go along, get along with these people, not realizing that they were out to destroy him. So here's the problem. You have now established a precedent where you don't have to give a shit about George Bush.
Well, and by voting against Jeb, you are also erasing your support for Bush.
Exactly.
That voting against Jeb, in addition to supporting Trump, I think gives you, forgiveness of your sin.
Well, your sin never happened, because what the magic Tea Party machine did was let the base voters pretend they'd never heard of George Bush.
Well, but they can't do that if they vote for Jeb.
There's exactly that. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
There's
the point.
Maybe that's the way to phrase it. Then,
exactly.
If you vote for Jeb, then you have to admit that George W. Bush existed.
And so by bringing Jeb into the argument, we now get to open the door and relitigate the Iraq War. And
although, did you see, Driftglass, on Crooks and Liars, that the number one Google search for Jeb Bush during the debate was, is Jeb Bush related to George W. Bush?
That's really Karl Rove.
No, really.
Work.
Yeah.
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 I'm saddened. I'm not surprised. But here's the thing.
Well, Driftglass, I don't mind if an 18-year-old who's a new voter has to search that. Although, really.
I do.
They haven't been paying attention this month, if that's the case. Yeah.
The existence of George Bush has been disproven by Republican science. He's a myth. He never happened. It never happened. Well, suddenly, George Bush is real, and the past actually happened, and all of the talking points, all of the things that the donor class has taught the base to say, all the Tea Party bullshit that they've been taught to mouth, that looks stupid. I mean, this is the problem. They were humiliated once by George Bush himself. And they've been humiliated repeatedly by having to say over and over again, well, you know, the real problem, George Bush kept us safe, even though you can look at the fucking calendar and know that's not true. They have been asked to repeat the most absurd lies just to keep the myth of George Bush at bay. The myth that Iraq was a stable and wonderful country when he left. The myth that they were invaded for all the right reasons. The myth that he kept us safe when he patently didn't. You can look at the calendar and see that. The base has been forced to drag the stinking albatross of George Bush around and mouth these platitudes about how it's not our fault, Bill Clinton was responsible for Osama bin Laden, and George Bush was an awesome president, which everyone knows is bullshit. So the base, through the vessel of Donald Trump, is being offered a natural extension of the Tea Party, which is, not only did I never vote for George Bush, I agree George Bush is a lying asshole. Yeah, he is. He sucks. He's a terrible person. I'm right with you there. Who the hell voted for this clown? And it's this, the people of the lie. Remember that book?
Yes.
M. Scott Peck. M. Scott Peck's second most famous book is about what happens when you build your entire personality around a lie. And the Republican Party, especially for the last 7 years, has been desperately clinging to a gigantic lie about who they are, what they did, and how they behaved during both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. And it has taken an enormous toll on their psyche. They have to lie to themselves constantly. They have to pretend that they never heard of George Bush or that George Bush was awesome, which is patently untrue and observably ludicrous. And they've had to say these ritual lines as liberals just make the universal blowjob sign every time they hear them because they know they're stupid. And Donald Trump comes along and says, you don't have to carry that shit around anymore. It's okay to call George Bush a dick and an incompetent liar because you had nothing to do with him, right?
Who didn't keep us safe.
He didn't keep us safe. Look at the goddamn calendar, you know? And for a substantial fraction, I'm guessing now, but for a substantial percentage of the Republican base, this came as an absolute blessing out of the sky.
Yeah. I
don't have to defend George Bush anymore because I never supported him. And you know what? He was a terrible president. And you know who else is even worse? Barack Obama, because he's, you know, a Kenyan sleeper cell monster. But I think we can all agree George Bush was awful. And that's what Jeb Bush brought to the race. He walked in the door as the head, the daddy, the putative father of a dysfunctional family at Thanksgiving. He's just gonna carve the turkey, serve it around, we'll all get along, and everything will be great. And Donald Trump stands up and says, your brother was a murdering psychopath who ruined this family. And you're a lying sack of shit. And your whole family's terrible. And
well, my mother's strong. Well, maybe she should run.
Yeah.
That exchange actually happened.
It did.
I'm just stunned.
It went to the dozens. So I know I've gone on about this a little bit long. From my point of view, it's terribly important to understand, I think, that none of this is terribly hard to understand. It's all very predictable when you understand how Republicans think of themselves, how their mental process. They live in such a constant, desperate state of denial, frantically trying to keep reality at bay. And Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio come along and say, just keep lying. Just keep lying. George Bush kept us safe. Iraq was wonderful. And Donald
until
Trump...
Until
Obama messed everything up. He's a monster. And Trump comes along and says, no, that's not true. Yeah, Obama sucks, but George Bush sucked too. Everybody knows it. Look at the frickin' calendar. And there's this collective sigh of, oh, thank God, we can loosen our belts now. we can stop pretending that George Bush was a good president. We don't have to take him responsibility for it. That's the
big time. Yep.
You know, we were never there. We had nothing to do with it. But Donald Trump is granting us the final absolution that the Tea Party started, which was taking the entire Bush presidency and completely dismissing, walking away from it and saying we had no responsibility for that at all. And that is an incredibly enticing offer. And that's why Trump's going to win the nomination.
I want to read this tweet to you, Jeff Glass.
Uh-huh.
If you concur with Trump's view of Bush on Iraq, weren't Michael Moore, Code Pink, and Barack Obama right all along?
Yes.
And the answer to that is, yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And that's the very, very liberal Jim Garrity from National Review magazine.
Well, there's
who doesn't want you to, you know, it goes against the catechism of conservatism to admit that Code Pink, Barack Obama, and Michael Moore might be right about the war. That can't be possible.
Because there's nothing more humiliating than being told by a liberal, I was right and you were wrong.
Yeah.
Because liberals are evil. And
so therefore, you have to reject Donald Trump because...
That's the exact language.
He agrees with Code Pink.
That's the exact language I think Eugene Robinson uses. It's their confession of faith.
Yep.
There's a catechism you have to say to be a good Republican. And a whole bunch of them are like, no, we're screw this. Here, we're nailing the theses to the door. We do not want to play this stupid Because it doesn't benefit us. It benefits the donor class. It benefits the people who want
to... That's a new term that started to use this week, because we've already named the Republican base for many months now. We know that the base does this and the base does that. What we haven't recognized, and I think we are recognizing this week, is that what we mean when we say GOP establishment is the donors.
Yeah.
Because they serve... they serve Sheldon Adelson. Yeah. That's who they serve. The Republican establishment, they aren't, you know, the old style legislators. They're not the people who just were good government, green eye shade, keep the budget down. These guys in the Republican establishment represent billionaires' interests only.
Yeah.
And there was a very interesting article in The Week. I want to thank the listener who tweeted this to us.
Uh-huh.
Called Conservatives Have Failed Donald Trump Supporters. It's by Michael Brendan Doherty. And he talks about these conservative writers. He had written an earlier article about Trump and the revolt in the Republican Party among the base voters against Republican establishment people. And he... got some responses back from people at National Review Online and The Federalist, which in which they criticized him for using racial identity politics to help poor whites feel better about dependency.
Yeah.
That's what Kevin Williamson said. And I just want to make it clear that this article is talking about the Republican base, the white blue collar voter who is going overwhelmingly for Trump. And these conservatives in their safe jobs, safe, well-paying jobs at National Review Online and The Federalist.
Their wingnut welfare jobs.
Wingnut welfare jobs are talking about these blue-collar white voters as, I'm just going to say it, as if they're black.
Yeah, with the same contempt they traditionally reserve.
The same contempt they usually reserve for, quote-unquote, those people.
Those welfare queens over there.
Yeah.
Those people over there, they have the same loathing of their own base.
Yep. And so this is from the article. Williamson says that he'd rather poor whites, quote, took the necessary steps to improve their condition in life, unquote. Mm-hmm. Nichols outlines some of these necessary steps, saying these men need to, quote, stop fleecing the disability system, to kick their addiction, to be fathers to their children, to get a job no matter how low or unappealing it is, and to stick with it until you get a better one. He implies that I, Brendan, am against this kind of virtue. That's wrong. It's great life advice, but it illustrates the problem I described. Issuing godly financial advice is the job of parents and pastors and personal finance gurus. It is not a substitute for politics or government. It is not the conservative movement's nor the Republican Party's job to tell voters to keep their fingernails trimmed and to proofread their resumes, wise as those things may be. And it should be plain as day that such tut-tutting is certainly not going to win the loyalty of the party's down-on-their-luck base. Uh-huh. Well, you could have told the African-American community that 30 years ago.
Yeah. And every year for the last God knows how many generations, because it's been going on forever. This is the core of American race politics has always been those people are out to take your stuff. And they're not worthy. They don't deserve it because they're lazy and they're shiftless and they don't have the same values that you do. And now that the economy, which has been piloted, which has been looted by our billionaire class.
By robber barons. Absolutely.
Has left everyone high and dry.
Except for 400 families who are buying the presidency for a Republican.
And they're parasites in the media who keep clucking their tongues and tut-tutting and saying, you know, just if you just had better morals, if you just had better values, if you just worked harder, and there's a lot of people, a lot of white middle class people who've been wiped out by the Great Recession who said, but I've been doing that my whole life, and all I've gotten is screwed. My job went overseas, my company went overseas, I had to train my replacement. What the hell has been going on? And the answer is you've been voting for the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
You've been voting for people who've been lying to you for 30 years.
And let's point out then that the claim then, because the response to that is always what?
Yeah. well,
you know, both sides are equally bad.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of responses, one of which is, well, you know, eventually it'll all trickle down. Eventually, supply side economics will supply you with a cheap house and cheap consumer goods. So you don't need to, you know, have a real job or anything because everything will be so inexpensive. No, they are working for their interests, and their interests involve turning you into cannon fodder for their plutocratic fantasies. Mm-hmm. And you've been going along with it.
And looting the treasury, because that is a guaranteed source of income.
Yep.
You know, I realized the other day, it horrified me to think about it, but, you know, if you gave a no-bid contract to Halliburton to fix the water system in Flint, you'd get Republican support.
You would, because everybody loves Halliburton. Everyone loves no-bid contracts.
And Dick Cheney would, you know, as long as it makes the stock market go up for privatizing such things, you could take and someone's going to suggest that. I swear to God, when I was blogging daily back at Blue Gal, you know, years ago, I made a joke on my blog that Halliburton would get a no-bid contract to clean up after Katrina. And a week later, they did.
Yeah.
And that was the Bush administration. And that's going to be the Rubio administration. Trust me, the reason Rubio is... did you see that interview with Sheldon Adelson where he said that the reason he didn't like some candidates was they didn't say... They didn't basically say, yes, sir, I'll do that for you.
Yeah.
And you know, I want somebody who's going to get something done. So when I suggest these things, when I make these suggestions, somebody says, well, we'll have to see. Then I'm not going to support them.
Right. And from his point of view, why would he?
He's
hiring an employee. Why would he hire an employee?
And so we know exactly, just like Newt Gingrich before him,
yep.
Marco Rubio said to Sheldon Adelson, yes, sir, I'll do that for you.
Absolutely.
I'll get that done.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now here's a giant check.
Yep.
And I don't think we're going to see the crossover, which is a true shame, but we are right damn close to where the populist movement was.
Well, and this is the thing that I did want to bring up, which is go back and read your history of the progressive movement, folks, and where we were when that movement happened. The only thing I'm concerned about, and maybe it's because I'm in the inside looking out, you know, the muckrakers had institutional support.
Yep.
Of magazines and who were paying them a salary to do what they did.
Yep.
So they had, you know, the bread on their table so they could keep investigating and writing about meatpacking and whatever else it was, you know, and the internet replaces that to a certain extent, but pay the writer, folks. But I mean, it's really.
But the meatpackers bought the newspapers.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
Sheldon Adelson bought the newspapers. And so it's an uphill battle. Hey, Driftglass, it's time for Bible Bitch.
Bible Bitch.
That's not scriptural.
Oh, I love Bible Bitch.
Speaking of uphill battles, I want to read from Paul's letter to the Hebrews. I always preface anything I read about from Paul with, you know, sometimes we have problems with Paul. Paul had, Paul was a product of his time. Let me put it that way.
We have issues with Paul.
We have issues with Paul, and that's okay. He was kind of, in many ways, when I think about him, I think he probably looked like Scalia. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know.
Just kind of, yeah, all right. But a good speaker.
Yeah.
You know?
A learned man.
A learned man. This is from Hebrews 12, and I've been thinking about this in light of all of the battles that we progressives have to fight. And I'll just read this.
Okay.
All these pioneers who blazed the way, all these veterans cheering us on, it means we'd better get on with it. Strip down, start running, and never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. Keep your eyes on Jesus, who both began and finished this race we're in. Study how he did it, because he never lost sight of where he was headed. And he could put up with anything along the way, cross, shame, whatever. And now he's there in the place of honor right alongside God. When you find yourselves flagging in your faith, go over that story again. Item by item, that long litany of hostility he plowed through. That will shoot adrenaline into your souls. Keep a sharp eye out for weeds of bitter discontent. A thistle or two gone to seed can ruin a whole garden in no time. Remember the time God's voice shook the earth to its foundations. This time he's told us this quite plainly, he'll also rock the heavens. One last shaking from top to bottom, stem to stern. The phrase one last shaking means a thorough house cleaning, getting rid of all the historical and religious junk so that the unshakable essentials stand clear and uncluttered. He's actively cleaning house, torching all that needs to burn, and he won't quit until it's all cleansed. By the way, that's from the Message, a modern translation of the Bible, so as you can tell, because it used the word adrenaline.
So God wants me to burn down what now? No. I don't care.
But
what
I am very interested in how much karma there is in, and Charlie Pierce did a wonderful write up of Jeb Bush in particular. How much of this whole Republican race is Greek melodrama, where Bush one was act one. And we go through, and then there's the act two where there's all the denial of this never happened. And then you get to act three, and every chicken comes home to roost.
Right.
And it comes home to roost in South Carolina. You want to talk about why that's important?
Yeah, there's something – I'm not a believer in karma except in principle. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see the karma train run over anyone. I try not to delight when it happens. I often fail. I often go when it comes home to roost, but it's like watching a rock fall that you throw into the sky. Of course, it's going to fall. That's gravity. There's a returning of things. And George one needed to win the presidency.
You're talking about Papa Bush.
Papa Bush.
Yes, Papa Bush.
Papa Bush was not doing well.
Poppy Bush. Yes.
Until Poppy Bush. Hired a guy named Lee Atwater, brought him into the fold, a filthy fighter if ever there was one. And he saved him from the perils of Michael Dukakis by fighting really dirty, by running Willie Horton ads, by teaching the Bush family the importance of fighting really dirty and of keeping their hands clean, of outsourcing the filth to someone else. Lee Atwater's proteges were George W. Bush and Karl Rove. So the next round of Bushes, we find ourselves in South Carolina again. We find Karl Rove diligently, as we say, rat-fucking John McCain. The whisper campaigns about him being crazy, about him having an illegitimate black child, on and on. Mm-hmm. Just screwed him, absolutely screwed that man, and stopped him dead. Bush had to stop him in South Carolina. He did. By deploying the filthiest kind of campaign nonsense you can imagine. And, of course, because the Bush are now royalty, keeping their hands clean. They stay away from that stuff. They just hire it out. They have people to do those sorts of things. And here we have Jeb in South Carolina, birthplace of two Bush presidencies, you might say, in a very real sense, who has come here to die. To watch his candidacy burn in the desert and die. Because, in large measure, the kind of behavior, the kind of stuff that his father and his brother turned into the normal everyday vocabulary of Republicans. Vicious, hateful, racist appeals, the worst kind of instincts, always going there, always staying there, being relentless about it, elevating that to the day-to-day vocabulary of the Republican Party. Well, that's now the day-to-day vocabulary of a guy named Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. and Marco Rubio, and Donald Trump. And it's burying Jeb. Because now Jeb wants to play nice and be fair and lets everybody stop doing this. And nobody's interested, Jeb. Nobody does that anymore, especially in South Carolina.
In South Carolina, where nasty politics is the way people do things. Yep.
So things have a way of coming around. And there would be a certain level of justice in watching the Bush family being wiped finally from our national life in the great state of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to talk for a minute about Illinois. Our Governor Hedge Fund, as you call him,
yes, Governor
Kasich, uh-huh. gave us a State of the State address yesterday.
Budget address.
A budget address. Yes. That's right. It was a budget address. Yes. Excuse me.
Except it wasn't a budget address.
It was, everything's so messed up. First of all, let's do 2 years of budget, not just one. And by the way, if you guys can't come to agreement, how about you give me all the power?
Right. It was
That's really essentially the points of his, that those are the talking points of his address.
It was not a budget address. Here are the numbers for this year, because we have been without a budget in Illinois for 8 months now, I believe, which is unprecedented, absolutely unprecedented.
And lots of social service agencies for autism and seniors and things where that are really needed have gone unfunded.
And shut their doors and laid people off. The Illinois State Museum shut down, closed doors. You were literally in the land of Lincoln, and all the Lincoln stuff is shut down because the state under Governor Hedges won't fund anything.
Unless there's a court order that they have to fund it.
Unless there's a court order that requires them to fund it, they won't do it, which is driving even his supporters crazy.
And he cut taxes when he got on board, when he came to office. First thing he did is cut taxes.
Well, he let the income tax go back to where it was, reset. But the essential thing was it cut taxes.
It cut revenues by a lot.
Yes, it did.
And now there's an emergency. And so what he wants is emergency powers to fix the problem that he created.
Just like they haven't flipped.
By cutting salaries and cutting needed services and cutting everything.
Yeah.
And not raising his taxes, billionaires' taxes.
We should say that Illinois has had a longstanding structural deficit problem for a long, long time.
Yeah, and has underfunded their pensions and like a lot of states had corruption and problems. And I'm not whitewashing anything the Democratic Party in Illinois has done.
But if you want to do it, you have to begin with a spirit of goodwill. You have to do it from an honest place. And Governor Hedge Fund is about using this crisis to gut the unions, to strip protections, to do all the things in the Koch brothers playbook. That's why he's here. That's why he's a guy who bought businesses, sold their assets, and fired their staff. And that's what he
wants to do. Yeah, he's Mitt Romney. And so I wanted to connect this in some way to Oprah, Oprah Winfrey. I don't have anything negative to say about Oprah. But there was an article in Vox this week about Oprah Winfrey and the Weight Watchers ads that she's been doing. Uh-huh. And pointing out that Oprah has had, has all the money in the world and has been putting on weight and losing weight and putting on weight and losing weight for decades. And this Vox article was written from the standpoint written by a woman who has faced these same struggles. And her point in the article was, perhaps if Oprah can't do it, I can't do permanent weight loss, maybe I shouldn't be beating myself up so much.
With all the tools Oprah has.
Right. With everything, you know, Oprah could live in a health spa for 365 days a year, no problem, and keep the weight off. If she's not able to do it, perhaps I shouldn't be so hard on myself, was the point of this article. And I made the point replying to it on Twitter to say that, you know, this struggle with weight is a positive part of Oprah's brand. It makes her just like you and makes her commitment to Weight Watchers and her journey with Weight Watchers believable. You know, it's what you want in a commercial every time. If you have a testimonial commercial, is you want everyone to believe, oh, yes, this is really happening to her.
She's just like me.
She's just like me, but she obviously is a good Weight Watchers customer and would be the right person. I can trust her.
Exactly.
You know, this trust issue. I can trust this endorsement because she really has struggled with this. And so when she says something about weight loss, I can trust her because I've followed her for 30 years. Uh-huh. The important thing to remember is that Oprah also last October, and she's been totally upfront about this, bought 10% of Weight Watchers.
Yeah.
She owns it. She is an owner. And the tweet that she sent out on January 26th about how she had lost 26 pounds and she was eating bread every day on the Weight Watchers diet, and isn't this a miraculous thing, caused the Weight Watchers stock that day to skyrocket.
Uh-huh.
And with I'm reading USA Today article about this. One tweet made Oprah Winfrey $5 million an hour.
Wow.
On just one tweet, January 26th, made Oprah Winfrey $5 million an hour on Tuesday afternoon. So, and you know, that is not to say that she's not genuinely doing the Weight Watchers diet and so forth and so on, but it's part of her brand.
Right, exactly.
It's part of Oprah's brand to be struggling with weight.
Right.
And it has made her money. So, and I think it's really important to recognize that same thing about Republican governors and yes. the donor class of the Republican Party, which yes. is... this destruction of government is part of their brand. It is what they use to sell themselves to the people who are buying, who are the Sheldon Adelsons and the other donor class Republicans. They only have to sell themselves to 400 families.
That's right.
And that's what, you know, the stock market was the only people that she had to sell this to.
What?
And she made $5 million an hour. The only people that Governor Rauner is talking to are his class of people.
Yeah. He doesn't have, well, first of all, he owns the Republican Party now, pretty much.
In Illinois, he owns every single Republican legislator yeah. because he's donated personally to their campaigns.
Yeah. So they are all beholden to him, which is mm-hmm. Fine.
And he can primary them.
Sure. And you know, doesn't need to make overt threats. He just reminds them of who signs the checks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's business as usual. But he's not.
There ought to be a law, Driftglass. There ought to be a law. And that's what the progressive movement yeah. was all about in the 19th century and what it needs to be about today.
When the guy at the post office who's there perennially asking me to sign petitions for term limits,
mm-hmm.
I finally got him to, you know, into a conversation about, well, no, I don't believe in term limits. I think term limits are the coward's way out. I think they're cheap fix for what the real problem is, which is getting money out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only thing you have to countervail against massive amounts of money is experience and knowledge. You know, you need people in government who know how government works. And if you're rotating people in and out every couple of years who have no idea where the bathrooms are, but they're all beholden to the same 400 families who are funding everything, guess what they're going to do while they're there? So let's get money out of politics first. And he didn't have anything to say to me after that because you're onto my bullshit. Okay, well then never mind. Let's go on to the next one. Let's talk about how awful it is that thus and so has been in office for 30 years. Yeah, it is awful. And that would be a terrible thing in a perfect universe. But we don't live in a perfect universe. We live in a universe with Bruce Rauner, who came to office as an ideologue. People thought, well, he's a businessman. He has a lot of money. There's this stuff he talks about government and efficiency, but he'll just, you know, he'll straighten things out. He'll run it. And anyone who's surprised that the guy who makes money looting companies, selling off their assets, firing people, and then moving on, it has come to Illinois to shut the government down, gut the unions, sell off the Thompson Center, and move on, it shouldn't be voting. Because you voted for this. This is who these people are. And if you want someone to come in and gut the government and leave you with nothing, then you voted for the right guy.
Yeah.
But if you think government is a necessary function in human events, that if we don't have politics, Aristotle, I believe, or Plato said, you know, politics is basically the alternative to war. You might not like it, but this is the best alternative to not shooting at each other is the art of politics. And politics mm-hmm. means cooperation. And in our country, it means you have a social safety net and you have a professional class of people who run things and you pay people a fair wage and you have rules and you have guidelines and you protect the environment and all those other good things, all of which the Republican Party, as it is currently constituted, is against. Because they're all beholden to people who want to get rid of government, except when it comes to protecting contracts and their privileges and their particular plot of land, then government's really important. But beyond that, screw the rest of y'all. And that's what happened in Illinois. That is what's happening right now. It's we got what we voted for. And if we don't learn from it, well, shame on us.
Well, we didn't like the tax increase that the last governor put in. That's what what happened. And it was an off-year election when Democrats didn't show up. So
and Bruce Rauner has more money than God, which is
exactly
really dangerous. Okay. When the ideologue you've elected, this is supposed to be a metaphor for Trump, in case you're not noticing. if the ideologue, if the lunatic you're electing is a billionaire and you can't touch him, you can't leverage him. You have no say over him. And he can just do whatever the hell he wants and not worry about anything.
His six houses are perfectly safe no matter what happens. Yeah,
that's kind of, I want someone who's deeply invested in government running well
mm-hmm.
and deeply
mm-hmm.
invested in the process by which we come to hard compromise over difficult problems to solve real human problems that affect real people.
Well, and Rauner is a lot like Kasich also in that on the outside he seems like a nice guy who's just reasonable. And that's what he seemed like in the election. And we have to talk about Kasich next week.
Scalia.
And also anyone who is interested, and you should be, in David Brooks and Ron Fournier, you ought to go over to driftglass.blogspot.com. We didn't get a chance to talk about that this week. We're running out of time.
Well, we should talk about Scalia real quick.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about just briefly is okay. Scalia.
Uh-huh.
And all of the hypocrisy on the right of when it was George W. Bush's last year in office and there was resistance on the Democratic side to rubber stamping the nominee of George W. Bush, actually Mitch McConnell said there is no rule that says we shouldn't speedily advise and consent the president on his nomination.
And those who say otherwise are making stuff up.
Yeah, making stuff up. The thing that makes this different to my mind is the automaticness of it.
Yep.
The idea that I don't care who he nominates.
Yeah.
We're not going to vote for it.
And saying it out loud.
Out loud. And our pal, Bill Scherr, who used to be of Liberal Oasis, and we missed that podcast very much. Just saying, Bill, Bill Scherr had an article this week about this whole Scalia thing and pointed out that a lot of these senators have primaries in March. And that once those primaries are over, they'll be a lot less stringent about because, you know, a lot of Republicans, believe it or not, have safe Senate seats. That's terrible to say.
Shocking, isn't it?
But if they aren't primaried from the right, then they can go ahead and advise and consent even Obama on a reasonable nominee. You know, he's not going to be able to nominate anyone from In Living Color, let me put it that way. But Kelly Ayotte, however, her primary is in September.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, she's going to be a holdout no matter what. And so it's going to be interesting to see. There's going to be some wavering. But it is all about the 2016 election and trying to keep your seat in the Senate, even though it's pretty clear to everybody that the Democratic Party is going to take back the Senate in 2016. Well, so
that's what made it so, I mean, as a liberal, mm-hmm. we've been saying this for a long, long, long time. And liberals have been pissing into the wind over this for a long, long time because nobody listens or they lie about it. But this was Mitch McConnell's Kevin McCarthy moment.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
When he said out loud what you're never supposed to say out loud, which is, essentially, no, anything he sends up is dead on arrival. Anything. And I'm going to make up some bullshit reason why that's true. But it doesn't matter who he sends up. If it's not a clone of Anton Scalia, followed immediately by Barack Obama's resignation, we're not going to even consider it. Period. End of sentence. We're done. Yep. Which has been the consistent philosophy of Republicans since the day Barack Obama was inaugurated.
And absolutely on the part of McConnell. That has been his policy.
We must break this guy. We must stop him. We must make him a one-term president. We will filibuster our own bills. We'll blow the government up if necessary. The entire predicate for how to deal with Barack Obama from the day he was inaugurated was block everything, stop everything, obstruct everything, destroy everything, filibuster everything, including your own bills.
Which they did.
And give him nothing and then blame him for the government being gridlocked.
And lack of leadership.
And
yes.
Any honest journalist can see that that's a strategy and it's disastrous and the fault for it lies on one side, which is why Ron Fournier doesn't see it that way because there is no more dishonest person plying the journalistic trade today than Ron. Both sides do it, Fournier. And if you'd like to know why, you can visit my blog, driftglass.blogspot.com.
There you go. I want to end today with a letter from listener RL, who wrote this morning and said, "You may have noticed on social media the Tim Cook letter to Apple customers refusing to crack the San Bernardino shooter's phones. It is quite popular with most of my friends, right-wingers, and co-workers alike. So in our daily lunch meeting today with some of his right-wing co-workers, I noticed that my right-wing friends are especially proud of Apple's refusal. One went so far as to say, terrorism is a problem, and should be dealt with. But the day we lose our freedoms because of it is the day the terrorists win. So I said, really? Why is it that in the proverbial ticking time bomb scenario, torture is acceptable even for an American citizen, but I refuse to decrypt a cell phone because that's a bridge too far?
Has this guy been in a walk-in freezer for like 10 years?
I don't know. But I thought that was a good retort.
Yeah.
You know? You're willing to torture an American citizen, but we aren't going to decrypt my cell phone, my iPhone.
And that's when they all took
the information on the iPhone, he says in his letter, the information on the iPhone is definitely more reliable than a torture victim's. So why is it okay to trade someone else's rights and privileges for freedom and not your own? I would like to think that I kind of blew their minds because the conversation quickly devolved to women and booze.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Another case of hypocrisy of the NIMBY variety. And my position on this is twofold. One is, I do believe that the geniuses at Apple can come up with a way to unlock one phone for the FBI, especially a 5C. I published an article yesterday. This is not a brand new iPhone. This is an iPhone 5C, and it is possible to unlock it or just give the FBI the code for that one phone. I mean, I do believe that Apple will ultimately be required by the courts to do that. That said, this confidence that Apple owners have that technology will protect them from invasion of privacy, I find hilarious because Apple is invading your privacy all the time.
Yeah.
The minute you buy that phone, they're looking at everything you click, everything you look at, all the music you play, and selling that information or using it to sell to advertisers. So there's that. And then the other thing is, you know, we need to get back to being protected, having our civil liberties protected in the courts.
Yeah, in the courts.
and if the FBI wants to break into a cell phone, they need a warrant. If they need to want to break into a house, they need a warrant. If they want to read your diary, they need a warrant.
Uh-huh.
And we need to get back to that principle. And then, I mean, I just keep going back to what if the FBI agent had investigated these San Bernardino terrorist killer, whatever they are, mm-hmm. and it's still being investigated, these perpetrators, so thoroughly that he knew that, it's going to, the 4-digit code is going to be his mom's birthday because everything that he did was his mom's birthday.
Uh-huh.
And just guessed lucky, just knew I can break into this phone right now. That what protects our civil liberties is the FBI knows that there is a vibrant court system that will deny the evidence, that will deny the evidence from that phone if you don't have a warrant to search it.
And it's really simple.
Yeah.
You get a warrant. You get a warrant.
And then, yes, Apple has to come up with a solution when there is a warrant to unlock a phone that, you know, there's a master key or there's something that I don't mind if the courts control them. You know, don't give that information to the FBI. Fine. You know, don't let them have a key that unlocks everything. Fine. But make it so that, I mean, first of all, I understand that there's also a whole lot of big money and proprietary stuff going on here.
Yeah.
But, make it so that, you know, there has to be a way that in a situation where there's a warrant and there's clearly a crime that's been committed, the people that were killed in San Bernardino deserve justice as well.
Yeah.
So that's my stand on it. And I'm sure we'll get mail that says, you don't understand anything about my iPhone.
And that's quite possibly true.
That's probably true. And you know, the majority of our listeners listen on iTunes. I understand that Apple is, you know, our daughter loves her iPhone 6. It's not a 6S. I can't remember which one it is. But that is her. She's the Apple adoptee in our house and loves it. So I understand brand loyalty in that regard. But got to come up with a solution to that. And I love that letter. So I wanted to share that, you know, wow, you can torture an American, but don't unlock my phone. Okay. Got it.
That sort of sums it right up.
Yeah. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Hobbs. Hobbs is a beautiful calico, 6 years old. She is named after Calvin and Hobbs because she looked like a tiger when she was a baby. So go over and check out Hobbs at our Facebook page and website. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local, but we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store. We got a letter from a listener who wanted to know if buying gift cards, if you buy a gift card for someone from Amazon via our link, do we get a percentage of that? And the answer is yes, we do.
We do?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
This person, this was funny. This person said he has something like 4 birthdays in March. And he said, yeah, I come from a family of teachers. And when school lets out,
they go mad.
They go crazy.
They run like weasels. Yeah.
And I did the math. I thought, yeah, June, and then you have a March birthday. Okay, all right. You go.
So that's what institute days are for. I had wondered all my years as a student what institute days were for. Now I know.
That's what in service means, don't you?
See, now it all makes perfect sense. And my mom and family, or most of them, are teachers. I should know the secret code, but they never told me this stuff. I had to pick it up on the street like everything else I know.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution. You can, too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. So, Drift Class, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Blue Gal, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
The Internet Kitties are worried this might be their last week to make Ben Carson jokes.
Oh, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are worried this might be their very last week to make Ben Carson jokes.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, loving, loving. Let's forget about the why and the cry and the shooting and the dying and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Drift Glass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jeff Glass.
All right, Science Fiction University, you have something special planned for us today, don't you, Jeff Glass?
I do. At a several readers' suggestion, I have decided to give up Science Fiction University and talk instead about romance novels from the 1970s.
No, you have not.
No, I have not decided to do that. Instead, we've decided to bring up the university portion and lower the science fiction portion of our show, the quiz portion of our show.
For now.
For now.
Yes.
We're not getting rid of the quizzes. I like them myself. They are fun little brain teasers.
They're very fun, yes.
They put me on to things I've never read before. But as most of you know, I'm a writer, and my wife is a writer, and I used to teach writing and facilitate writing groups, specifically science fiction writing groups. And so I'm having a fun time reading over some old stories, some old canonical science fiction classic stories from the late 40s, early 50s, up through 60s and 70s, with an eye towards reading them aloud here, just a couple of paragraphs, and having a little discussion between me and my very intelligent wife on what makes it work as a story. A little
yes.
story mini workshop.
Fair use, fair use.
Yes. So a flip of a coin this week was either going to be the Arena or the Cold Equations. And I have Arena up in front of me, so I might as well use
okay.
that. The Arena is by Frederick Brown. It was published a very long time ago. I don't have the publishing date, but I think it was late 40s. You might know it as the Gorn episode of Star Trek.
Star Trek, the original series.
The original series. It is not exactly the same, as you will see very clearly, but the idea of a one-on-one combat between a human and an alien to settle a massive dispute. This was the first time this was used in a story. But I'm going to read it and ask you to listen as an audience carefully and then see what you remember from the reading and see what's interesting and what's not interesting. Remember, this is a very old story. This is not anything that would be published in any magazine today because it's been done already a million times.
And Driftglass, I did look it up. It is Frederick Brown first published this story, Arena, in the June 1944 issue of Astounding Magazine. Yeah,
that's about right. The Cold Equations was 1954, I think. Maybe we'll do that. If this turns out to work really well, we'll do the Cold Equations next week, or we will take suggestions from our readers and listeners. The one thing I would suggest is that we're not going to do novels, because novels are just... You don't want to hear me read the first three chapters of anything to tell you how the structure works. Structure is much easier to understand and get into with a really short story. That's a classic that everybody can look up and follow along with if you wish.
Exactly. And that's easily available for free online and doesn't get us into copyright trouble.
Exactly.
And also, most writing workshops will teach the short story. They're not. It's just beyond the realm of what is possible to do in teaching you how to write a novel. You really need to start with something shorter.
There are some graduate programs and there are some elective programs where you can one-on-one work with a professor on your novel.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the exception, absolute exception. Short stories you should think of short stories as the final chapter of the novel you never wrote. So...
And you're going to read just a little bit of it.
Just a little bit. First few paragraphs.
Okay.
It should have certain elements to it that we'll get to after we talk about it. But I bring you now from 1944, Arena by Frederick Brown. Carson opened his eyes and found himself looking upwards into a flickering blue dimness. It was hot and he was lying on sand. And a rock embedded in the sand was hurting his back. He rolled over onto his side, off the rock, and then pushed himself up to a sitting position. I'm crazy, he thought. Crazy or dead or something. The sand was blue, bright blue, and there wasn't any such thing as a bright blue sand on Earth or any of the other planets. Blue sand under a blue dome, that wasn't the sky, nor yet a room, but a circumscribed area. Somehow he knew it was circumscribed and finite, even though he couldn't see to the top of it. He picked up some of the sand in his hand and let it run through his fingers. It trickled down to his bare legs. Bare? He was stark naked, and already his body was dripping perspiration from the enervating heat. Coated blue with sand wherever sand had touched it. Elsewhere his body was white. He thought, this sand is really blue. If it seemed blue only because of the blue light, then I'd be blue also, but I'm white, so the sand is blue. Blue sand? There isn't any blue sand. There isn't any place like this place I'm in. Sweat running down his eyes. It was hot, hotter than hell. Only hell, the hell of the ancients, was supposed to be red and not blue. If this place wasn't hell, or was it? Only Mercury among the planets had heat like this, and this wasn't Mercury. Mercury was some 4 billion miles from question mark. It came back to him where he'd been, in a little one-man scouter outside the orbit of Pluto, scouting a scant million miles to one side of the Earth Armada, drawn up in battle array, there to intercept the outsiders. We'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a good place to stop.
Now,
wow. We're going to do Recall?
Do a quick Recall.
Talk about Recall. What that is, if people haven't taken a short story workshop, what Recall is.
Recall is, you do it during the reading, but I also like to do it a week later or 2 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
It's what details do you remember from the story? Details don't necessarily make a story great, but it makes it memorable. So what do you, I forget the author's name, Elmore Leonard mm-hmm. used to say that I write and I take out the stuff nobody's going to read anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the idea is, what are the vivid, striking details that you remember after the story's written? After you've read it, and after you've had to sit with it away from it for a while. And these are the ones that should come back to you. So what do you remember, Blue Gal?
I remember hot, blue sand, mm-hmm. Not the sky,
uh-huh.
Where is he, white skin, scientific method. It seems like he's asking questions as a scientist would. He's lots of questions. Those are my immediate recalls.
Yeah. Well, it's not fair because I'm looking at the story, so it's but the way you jump into it, our protagonist opened his eyes. That's as good a place as any. You know, you are in Mibius race. You're in the middle of things. You jumped right into the middle of the story. You don't know how you got here. Literally, you have no idea how you got here or why. But the blue of the sand and the blue of the area and the heat, these are all sensory things. These are all things that you touch and feel and smell and taste. Those are the most powerful elements of a story when it comes to memory. What's the and the vividness of the details? How you can feel it in your fingertips. How you can feel the sand running through your fingers. You can feel the perspiration dropping off of you. Because everybody's been really hot. And everybody's been to a beach somewhere and knows how sand feels. And then you introduce the element of alienness. You suddenly realize you're not just passed out on an island somewhere because you had too many margaritas and the nice native people that you thought were your friends have taken your wallet and gone away. No, you're someplace way far away. First of all, we know that this guy knows what Mercury feels like. We know that he remembers, oh, I was out near Pluto. So he's in some sort of science fiction universe that the entire solar system has been not just explored, but has people floating around in it. And that they are arrayed in an armada against the outsiders. It could only be coming from the outside of the solar system. And it goes on for several pages. But that's what makes this thing work. It gives you an immediate sensory impact of what, you know, of smell, touch, feel, hear, see. And it tells you immediately that you are in an alien environment, one that you don't have, you're not in currently. And more importantly, this is something that good science fiction doesn't usually do. If it's good science fiction, it won't dwell on the details of the gadgetry. It doesn't tell you. It doesn't tell you how the ship works. It doesn't tell you how the phasers work. It doesn't get into the physics of how things work. It just tells you where you are and what you're doing. And there's an enemy. There's an element of complete surprise, and you're thrown into a completely alien situation. And that's really important. You should have someone in your story who does not know what's going along. And that we call that person the ignorant device for exposition. The person to whom you have to explain everything, that being the proxy for the audience. Middlechild and I were talking about this yesterday when it comes to Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
I mentioned that House is Sherlock Holmes. She's a big fan of the new Sherlock Holmes. Luther, someone was telling me about the TV series, uses the Sherlock Holmes template. And I said that one of your favorite shows, House, is Sherlock Holmes.
House MD, yeah.
Yes. And I asked her if she knew why Watson was there. And it was like, well, no, not really. Because someone needs to be the brilliant asshole who solves the mystery. And someone needs to be the ordinary audience member who documents it. And understands it.
And is amazed by it.
And is amazed by it. And interprets it in normal language to the audience.
Yeah,
and that's the function of that person in the story. So
he's the audience. Yeah. Yes, he is.
And this is science fiction during the era when humans had to win always.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Humans had to win, but the aliens in the story are truly alien. There is a true existential conflict, and you are thrust smack into the middle of it with enormous stakes riding on the outcome of this battle. But I'm hoping a little bit of a taste of what Science Fiction University might be from time to time in the future.
Thank you, Drift Class. I think this would be kind of fun to keep doing this every. I did want to point out there was a Twitter hashtag a couple of weeks ago. There are a number of women PhDs on my Twitter stream who like to analyze romance novels as fiction, you know, good fiction. Or there was a website called Smart Bitches Trashy Books. I don't know if they're still around, but
I remember that.
The idea is that some of these books are actually well-written novels in addition to being romance novels. And but they were making fun of opening lines of a bad romance novel. And there was this hashtag about, I don't know what the hashtag was, but it was something like, you know, bad romance or something like that. And sure enough, every single person that tweeted the first sentence of their bad novel talked about how the hero smelled in that sentence. His sweat smelled like donkey breath and, you know, mead, something like that. So, but those sensory issues, those touch, taste, smell, how the hero of the story, and we have to assume at the beginning of this novel, how do you know he's a hero?
You don't. You only know he's the protagonist because he has the most lines.
Tell us about the difference between a protagonist and a hero, though.
Well,
because there is a difference.
There used to be none.
Yeah. It used to be white American male military guy in 1945 was the hero.
Or Greek, you know, epic hero was the hero.
Yeah.
The heroes
yeah.
had tragic flaws and so forth. But in the era of the anti-hero, your story's main character can be a very unpleasant, unhappy person. But a hero in a traditional sense, a protagonist in this sense, should be the main character of the story. They should have most of the lines. And they should have an antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
They should have an enemy. And the traditional enemies are what? Man against nature, man against God, man against man. And the fourth one that came into existence relatively recently in literature, not in the last 10 years, but is man against himself. The internal struggle for your own soul. And so you can reduce almost any story, no matter how terrific, to a single line or a single concept. I mean, we were talking earlier about Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
What's the theme of Chinatown?
Find the girl.
Find the girl. It's a wonderful, it's an awesome, it's an epic movie. If you haven't seen it, shut up. Stop listening to me. Go see it right now. But it's really simple. It's find the girl. And the bad guy, the antagonist actually says it, you know,
just
find the girl,
just find the girl. Yes.
And so you can boil this stuff down to really simple rules. So in this case, and in most fiction, the hero and the protagonist are the same person. And in this case, it's you because you're cheating a little bit because you know the genre, you know when it was written. So the human is always going to win. The human is almost always going to be the good guy. Except when he comes up against another human, in which case then, you know, you have a different kind of science fiction. But the aliens are foul beasts and they're out to take over the Earth and despoil our women and probably steal our comic books. And we can't have that. Up with this, we shall not put. But the cold equations, for example, which we'll talk about next week if this goes over reasonably well, is man against nature.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, in this case, man against physics.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy are the laws of physics itself. And it's a wonderful, stark, unhappy story. And I'm not going to go into it now, but it is a model of storytelling efficiency and a very clear narrative path. And that's a story you could write right now. You could shoot it right now and it would go over really well. So welcome to Science Fiction University 2.0.
Right. I just wanted to add something about hero versus anti-hero, too. Uh-huh. Think about Al Pacino in The Godfather. Think about Dustin Hoffman in Little Big Man. These people are not Greek heroes.
Exactly.
But they are the anti-hero of the story and the villain of the story in some regards. I mean, I look at... We could do 3 hours on The Godfather who's the hero of The Godfather, you know?
Well, but so, and you don't even need to talk about the hero, but you can talk about the tragic flaw of the main character. What is the tragic flaw is his family.
Yep.
And
his commitment to family as opposed to doing the Greek tragedy. Yep.
Like Jeb Bush, it really.
Well, I was going to say, just like the 2016 presidential race, which we're going to talk about next, we always record Science Fiction University first. So let's move on to our political podcast and continue this talk about tragedies.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. I hope you like it.
Thank you. If you like us, we want feedback. Send some email to us at proleftpodcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think.
And,
thanks.
And if you have any suggestions for stories you would like us to take a cut at or sort of introduce through this forum. One story we will not be doing is Hardcore Harry.
who Junior Dude is absolutely freaking out about this movie.
Excitedly.
Very excited about Hardcore Harry. If you haven't heard of it, it is a movie coming out next month that is basically filmed like a first-person shooter video game. It is in the first person.
Yes.
The whole movie is in the first person. I'm going to find that very annoying to watch. But
it's you running and exploding things for an hour and a half.
You run and explode, and then you get the girl with the big boobs.
Who's your wife?
Who's your wife? Your wife? Oh, she's the blonde woman with the big boobs. Turns out to be your wife. You have to rescue her.
Or is she?
Or is she?
So basically, it's exactly like Chinatown. It's find the girl.
No.
Find the girl.
But it is fine. You're right. It is find the girl.
Uh-huh, it is.
We were talking about Casablanca the other day. Exactly. That the first half of the first 40 minutes of Casablanca is find the girl. Mm-hmm. But It is. That is a big theme in literature and film. All right.
Amazingly, isn't it? It's amazing that, and you know what? Let's leave them with this. You could write a completely alien short story about aliens, alien motivations in an alien language, and no one would read it. What makes a really good science fiction story is the human element. You got to bring people and their problems and their emotions. You have to put human nature at the center of the story to make your audience care about it at all. And that's the important thing. So Find the Girl, totally legitimate plot in any genre.
Well, and I think all of the gadgetry and science fiction setting and, you know, aliens and weird sand and strange lights and foreign planets, all of that is terrific. If you don't have a good plot, it's not a story.
Exactly. It doesn't matter. It's just a diorama. It
doesn't matter. Right. All right. Thank you very much, Driftglass. This was fun.
My pleasure. I love doing this. And see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.